From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The man who loves to hate. Today, a look at the Reverend Fred Phelps, an anti-gay pastor, who picketed last night a vigil for Billy Jack Gaither, murdered in Alabama by two men who say they killed him because he was gay. Also, the president of Colombia's Human Rights Commission will talk about how the killings of the three North American activists may affect Colombia's fragile peace process. And on this 40th anniversary of the Tibetan uprising, an interview with movie producer Melissa Matherson. She wrote the script for Kundun. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Two executions took place last night. A Missouri prisoner whose case inspired a Vatican plea that his life be spared was put to death early today for killing a prison guard during a 1983 riot. Roy Roberts was executed by injection at Potosi Correctional Center, muttering, "You're killing an innocent man," before he died at 12:07 at the Missouri prison. His fate was sealed after Governor Mel Carnahan rejected a clemency request. 6 weeks after he commuted another prisoner's death sentence to life after a personal request from the Pope. Hours earlier, George Quesenberry was executed by injection in Jarrett, Virginia. This news from South Africa. Police arrested four people for questioning today in a wave of political violence that has left five dead as political leaders meet to try to end the bloodshed. Officials of the African National Congress and United Democratic Movement, a small opposition party, met with police in Cape Town, where the killings occurred since Sunday. An ANC politician was first gunned down, followed by four local UDM officials. The latest burst of political killings has worried many South Africans that the bloodshed will grow ahead of the June 2nd presidential election. Mexico's government announced yesterday it has invited UN human rights investigators to visit the country a day after Amnesty International issued a report critical of its justice system. Such visits are among the recommendations made by the London-based human rights groups in its report, which alleged that abuses by the army and police and an action by courts have created a human rights crisis. Meanwhile, an independent UN human rights experts accuse Peru of having made large number of arbitrary arrests in its fight against terrorism and called for further reforms in the judiciary. Two experts from the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, who carried out an investigation in Peru a year ago, expressed serious concern that military courts have violated due process by trying more than 1,600 civilians since August of 1992. Ecuador, armed with increased powers under a newly declared state of emergency, government troops prepare to surround Ecuador's vital industries as workers across the country called for a nationwide strike to protest economic reforms. The 48-hour strike is beginning today in the midst of a deep economic crisis. President Jamil Mahmoud yesterday declared a 60-day state of emergency that limits freedom of movement and assembly and gives him the authority to order strikers back to work. Unions have threatened to disrupt production of oil, Ecuador's main export, if the president does not back down on reforms that have caused prices to soar and a bill now in Congress that calls for deep public spending cuts. Indian groups have blocked highways in northern Ecuador by digging trenches and dragging toppled trees across them. Road traffic to Colombia has been blocked. The president has extended through tomorrow an emergency bank holiday that has shut banks since Monday to keep people from withdrawing their savings and anticipation of drastic economic reforms. This news from Chile. A woman whose father was executed by troops after the 1973 military coup filed a lawsuit yesterday against the former dictator, General Augusto Pinochet. The action brought to 19 the number of such suits facing Pinochet, who is in police custody in London. Jessica Tapia's father, union activist Benito Tapia, was one of the 72 dissidents shot in October 1973 by troops, according to a report by the civilian government that succeeded Pinochet in 1990. Pinochet's legal fate now rests with Britain's House of Lords, which is to rule whether the 83-year-old ex-dictator will be extradited to Spain to face charges of genocide and murder. This news from Havana, the father of an Italian killed in the bombing of a Havana hotel, accused the United States and violent Cuban exiles of masterminding the plot leading to his son's death. This happened yesterday at the trial of a Salvadoran man who faces the death penalty for the string of bombings. The victim's father, Justino Del Selmo, blamed the United States government and the counter-revolutionary mafia of Miami, as he put it, for the death of his son, Fabio, in a September 4, 1997 explosion at the Copacabana Hotel. Cuban officials say the activities of Raul Ernesto Cruz León and another Salvadoran to be tried next week were financed by the Miami-based Cuban American National Foundation and organized by Luis Posadas Carriles, a Cuban exile. The foundation has denied the allegations, but the New York Times reported in July that Posada had admitted the foundation helped finance those attacks. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners.
You know, Juan, that last news story that I just read about the trial going on in Havana of the man, the Salvadoran man, accused of the series of bombings and last year in Cuba at hotels, and the father of the Italian tourist who was killed at the Copacabana. When I went down to Cuba last year, I also went over to the Copacabana, and his father would not leave Cuba, the Italian tourist's father. He said he loved Cuba, and he stayed there. He kept to himself, and now he has testified at the trial, saying he blames the United States and the Miami-based Cubans, organized by the Cuban American National Foundation, for the support of those bombings.
Yeah, let's see if that makes it onto the national network news this evening.
That's right. But Juan, before we move on with the show, I just wanted to congratulate you for winning this year's George Polk Award for your body of work, for your body of literature and columns. No, not for your body, Juan. And I'm looking at the New York Daily News, which has a whole piece on you as opposed to by you today. And it talks about how the chair of the awards committee, Robert Spector, said your work exudes passion and honesty. He said what we like most was the integrity and intensity of his writing. So congratulations.
Well, thank you, Amy. Although as many in the New York Police Department would say, they got the wrong guy. And congratulations to you also for the we're going to be sharing the Polk Award this year in terms of your reporting on Chevron in Nigeria.
That's right. Actually, the documentary Drilling and Killing, Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship, has won the Polk Award. Congratulations also to Jeremy Scahill, who co-produced it with me, and Dred Scott Keyes, who engineered that documentary. But I also want to put out the biggest thank you for all of us to the listeners around the country who've made it possible for us to continue to do this kind of work. And this award really belongs to all of you, keeping the non-commercial airwaves alive and open so that we can bring people the voices of the Niger Delta, people who were the first ones to let us know that Chevron had flown in the Nigerian mobile police and Navy last May 28th to a protest of Niger Delta villagers who were tired of their area being spoiled by oil spills, tired of the wealth being taken out of their land. And the military was flown in and they opened fire, killing two villagers and critically wounding a third. And now we hear it has happened again. And the latest that's come out of that, and we'll let people know the day that he holds a news conference, Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich is holding a news conference to announce calling for an investigation, a congressional investigation into Chevron's activities. In fact, four Chevron executives went to Kucinich's office last week to meet with him, I suppose to head off this investigation. And amazingly enough, behind closed doors, despite the fact we played for our listeners Mike Libby, the spokesperson for Chevron in San Francisco, denying any connection Chevron has with the military in Nigeria, behind closed doors, the executives confirmed everything that we had found in Drilling and Killing, Chevron's involvement in the military and the killings in Nigeria. And speaking of news conferences, just before we move on, today there will be two news conferences, one in New York and one in Los Angeles, where we will be reporting back on our first delegation visit to Lori Berenson, the American being held in Peru for life. She was convicted of being a traitor to the fatherland. She did not see her judge. He was wearing a hood. When she was sentenced, the soldier wearing a hood held a gun to her head. She could not hear the case against her, could not defend herself. She has not been seen by the outside world except by her parents and government investigators for 3 years. And I was part of a delegation with the Office of the Americas, which is based in Los Angeles, where one of the news conferences is going to be held today, where we got into the prison last week and spoke for the first time to Lori Berenson in New York. We'll be reporting back at 777 UN Plaza, which is the big church center across the street from the United Nations. So we will continue to let our listeners know the latest there. And if you were just listening to the headlines, you did hear that independent UN human rights experts are again accusing Peru of having made a large number of arbitrary arrests. And these UN human rights experts have found that Lori Berenson is being arbitrarily detained. Well, we're going to move from Peru now to Colombia. And regular listeners know we've been covering this extensively over the last few days, following the deaths of three North Americans last week. And Colombia is certainly an issue we have taken up many times before these three deaths. In fact, while I was in Peru, Juan, before they were killed, you were doing a piece on human rights in Colombia. But rebels from Colombia's guerrilla group, the National Liberation Army, the ELN, turned over the body yesterday of a French engineer kidnapped in November, who apparently died of a heart attack last week while he was being held. Claude Steinmetz was working under contract for oil giant BP Amoco, that's British Petroleum Amoco, and apparently died on the same day that three American activists were killed in northeastern Colombia. Venezuela has said the bodies of the Americans, Ingrid Washnawatak, Lahee Gay, and Terence Freitas, will be flown back to the United States today after a few days' delay. Their bodies were found in Venezuela last Friday, close to the border with Colombia. The killing of the three Americans has underscored here in the United States the dangers that human rights defenders face in Colombia, where they're under constant threat of death from right-wing paramilitary groups allied with power structures and with the Colombian military. They must also contend with guerrilla groups, which have vast and complicated interests in Colombia's rich and vast lands. The three Americans were taken from UA traditional territory, a community that has challenged Occidental Petroleum's plans to conduct drilling on their land. Their situation is not unique in Colombia. Many other communities are being threatened by large multinationals with logging, mining, and fishing interests. Paramilitary groups have allied themselves with some of these companies and with Colombia's large landowners in their quest to control and protect as much valuable land as they can. Today, we're taking a look at some of these complex issues. We'll also look at what the killings of the three North Americans may mean to Colombia's peace process. In the background, you may hear some noise. It is Walter Krakmal, our translator, translating for one of our guests. We're joined right now in the studio by Senator Piedad de Córdoba, senator from Antioquia and president of the Colombia Human Rights Commission. We're also joined in the studio with us here in New York by Gloria Flores. She's president of the Association for Alternative Social Policy, known as MINGA. Gloria is one of four Colombia human rights activists who have received the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award in November of 1998. We're going to begin right now with the head of the Congressional Human Rights Commission, Senator Piedad de Córdoba. Can you tell us what you think these killings of the three North Americans mean for the peace process in Colombia?
Sí, yo pienso que el asesinato de los tres de las tres personas americanas.
I think the murder of these three North Americans might represent a huge obstacle to the peace process.
The
responsibility for these deaths falls into the hands of the FARC, who are currently being accused of that.
And have you seen in the past difficulties in terms of initial accusations of who's responsible then being changed or being subject to attack by people who investigate further?
Sí,
You're listening to Democracy Now! As Juan's question is translated to the head of the Congressional Human Rights Campaign.
No,
that doesn't happen. Very difficult. If the responsibility belongs to a certain group, that group assumes that.
But that's a
very delicate matter.
Because we have seen in other countries, they would be called disinformation campaigns, where one group attempts to attribute to another group a crime that the public revolts against or finds terrible.
It could be
that at a certain moment it would be a different group from the guerrillas, could be the paramilitaries, that they commit the crime and they try to attribute that crime to the guerrillas. It's a delicate matter because it stands in the way of the peace process, especially when there's an ethnic community in the middle, as is the case now.
Que de todas maneras Estados Unidos estaba intermediando, hablando con
the United States was playing an intermediary role in the dialogue with the FARC. And there's also the issue of controlling drug traffic. So it'd be very easy for another group to have committed it. But not the guerrillas, not the guerrilla groups, would be another group, and that's really hypothetical.
Gloria Flores, what did the North American killings mean for the grassroots organizations like yours, the Association for Alternative Social Policy?
We contextualize these as an attempt against the defense of human rights in our country. Because these three North American people, Terry and the two indigenous leaders, had been accompanying the struggle of to defend cultural and economic rights of indigenous peoples against the exploitation by Oxy in Colombia. Occidental Petroleum. They had carried out a series of denunciations here in the United States about the role that multinational corporations have played in indigenous territories in our country. And that's why we consider it an attempt against the defense of human rights. And it is added to the long list of Colombian human rights activists who have been murdered in our country. Within a period of 12 to 13 years, 36 activists have been slain, 36 defenders of human rights. More than 26 have been exiled from our country, and many offices that defend human rights locally and regionally have been closed. So we could say that in our country there are no guarantees for the legitimate exercise of the defense of human rights.
Nos preocupa que la comunidad internacional,
it concerns us that the international community,
que apoya nuestra lucha, sea
which supports our struggle, would be affected directly by these attacks.
We're talking to Gloria Flores, who is president of the Association for Alternative Social Policy. Also joining us here for just a few days in the United States is Senator Piedad de Córdoba, senator from Colombia, president of the Colombian Congressional Human Rights Commission. We'll continue with this discussion in just a minute, and then we're going to go to this 40th anniversary of the Tibetan uprising, and we are going to finally talk about a reverend who may be not known to many, Reverend Fred Phelps, who has been dismissed by some, but who is leading protests at vigils of men killed because they are gay. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Please stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and we're talking about the implications of the killing of the three North Americans last week for the Colombian peace process, and also putting these killings into the context of the larger number of killings of Colombians over the years, particularly Colombian human rights defenders. Our guests are Gloria Flores, president of the Association for Alternative Social Policy from Colombia, and Senator Piedad de Córdoba, who is president of the Congressional Colombian Human Rights Commission. Juan?
Yeah, I'd like to ask Senator de Córdoba, in your province of Antioquia, there's been many, many human rights violations, and I'm interested whether your commission will be doing – could you tell us a little bit about the situation in your province, and also whether your commission will be doing its own investigation of the killing of these three Americans or North Americans, or whether you will be depending largely on the government to investigate it?
Sí. A ver, en Antioquia,
particularmente, especially,
hay de mucho tiempo atrás,
from a long time back,
hechos de violaciones,
there have
de
been
respeto frente a los
violations
derechos humanos. And disrespect
for human rights.
Regiones,
it's perhaps one of the regions, the most violent regions in the country,
rica,
especially because it's a rich region that has geographical spaces and that are geopolitically very important, and because on top of that, perhaps the greatest number of displaced people in the country has found themselves there, and the greatest number of massacres, as well as the highest rate of murders of defenders of human rights, political leaders belonging to different traditional different political lines that differ from traditional politics. I would say quite violent, quite difficult situations, especially the region of Urabá. On the border with Panama, and the region that borders on the Chocó, which is a very rich region in terms of biodiversity, and where recently studies have found oil as well. There are other regions of the department that are also very rich in terms of minerals, and that has brought about the displacement, which has to do with the richness of those lands.
Y yo como presidenta tuve una reunión en el día de ayer.
I had a meeting yesterday as president with representatives from Terry's family.
Vamos a hacer una investigación. Vamos
we're
a
going to carry out an investigation. We're going to undertake that directly.
Ya he tenido oportunidad de hablar con
I've
el fiscal
had the chance
general de la
nación, to speak to the Attorney General, the nation Attorney General, who I think has not only the responsibility to investigate, but has also been a defender of human rights. Therefore, the message I was able to give Terry's family yesterday, as well as the families of the other indigenous women, is that we are going to assume the responsibility, not just for investigating, but getting to the bottom of it. We want it to be known, to be known, to be denounced, and we want the truth to come out. We have to find a way not only to guarantee defenders of human rights, but also a way to reach peace.
Senator Piedad de Córdoba, some of the areas in Colombia you just mentioned are areas of high Afro-Colombian concentration. Is there violence particularly targeted at Afro-Colombians like yourself?
Sí, claro.
Yes, of course.
Desde mucho tiempo atrás.
From a long time back, a much more covert form of violence, intermittent violence, spread over a great period of time. But lately, because of the interests represented by large-scale economic organizations, the attitude towards the Afro community has been extremely harsh.
O sea, ha sido una población que that no ha tenido el miramiento ni ha tenido el respeto por el ejercicio pleno de su ciudadanía, esta como el reconocimiento de los derechos
exercise
civiles,
of its human rights,
sociales,
political and cultural rights. And now, at this time, they want to displace them from their lands.
el respeto y el reconocimiento de esos derechos que han poseído ancestralmente. O sea, que yo pudiera
in violation
decir
of their
momento,
ancestral rights. So I could say that at this time, the black community in my country is directly a victim of that violence and that a subhuman displacement that has registered in a great part of that region.
I wanted to bring a third person into this conversation, Daniel Garcia Pena, who is a guest scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and former High Commissioner for Peace in Colombia from 1995 to last year. During his time as High Commissioner, he acted as government envoy in the peace negotiations with the guerrillas and has also worked on addressing the issue of paramilitary violence and helped to form the National Peace Council in Colombia. Daniel Garcia Pena, what do you see as the implications of the killing of the three North Americans in Colombia? Actually, it looks like right over the border in Venezuela. And as you are you as convinced as the U.S. government that it was the FARC?
Well, first of all, good morning and a special greeting to Piedad and to Gloria. As a Colombian, it really makes us proud to have women like them defending human rights, and it gives a little bit of hope towards the future. As far as the killings go, I think there's still a lot of questions that have to be answered. The fact is that the guerrilla organization that has been accused of this, the FARC, has denied so far their being responsible, has stated that they are going to undertake an investigation to determine exactly what has happened. But regardless of what they come out with, I think there already has been a very serious negative effect on the peace process. The accusations on the part of the State Department are also backed by the UWA Indian community, and this has really been a setback for the peace process. But I think that it will really depend upon what the FARC investigation determines, and that will allow us to understand more clearly what would be the effect.
I'd like to ask Daniel Garcia Pena. Our understanding is that we've just been told that the FARC has announced that their investigation, which will take about 3 days, the results of it will be announced tomorrow. But you being in the United States and in Washington, D.C. now, I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about the irony that for years there have been human rights violations in Colombia. As we've noted on previous shows, hundreds of people victimized as a result. Thousands of people have been killed throughout this long period of time. But only now, with the death of these three U.S. citizens, is now a major focus by the rest of the world, especially here in the United States, being focused on these violations. Any thoughts on that?
Unfortunately, you're right. You know that all human beings are created equal, and every death should be equally condemned. But unfortunately, in the new world order, as it's so called, there are the fact of American citizens being involved. Well, has different implications. Although, you know, I think that in Colombia, there have been recent assassinations of human rights activists that have really led to mobilizations within the country. A few years back, two very prominent investigators of CINEP, Mario Calderon and Alvarado, were killed, and that led to huge mobilization within the country. Last year, Eduardo Maña was assassinated, and that led to an enormous march in the city, so in Bogotá. So I think that we are slowly in Colombia beginning to come to grips with the reality of the fate of human rights workers. But you are right in saying that internationally speaking, these deaths went largely unnoticed, and it is now with the deaths of the three Americans that there is more concern, which I think is unfortunate that we would have to have waited, and that the lives of Colombians that have been taken did not have the same effect. But I think that it's better late than never, and if the death of these three Americans can help to mobilize public opinion internationally in favor of peace and human rights in Colombia, well, I guess we have to work with that reality.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us and all of our guests. Danielle Garcia-Pena, guest scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., former High Commissioner for Peace in Colombia. Our guest in the studio, Colombian Senator Piedad de Córdoba from Antioquia and president of the Colombian Congressional Human Rights Commission. And also with us, one of the winners of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award, Gloria Flores, who is president of the Association for Alternative Social Policy in Colombia, as we continue our coverage of what is happening in Colombia. I'm just thinking about the close friends of Terry Freitas yesterday on the show, Abby Reyes and Leslie Werpsa, along with Carlos Salinas of Amnesty International, saying what a horror it would be if, as a result of the executions of the three North Americans, that U.S. aid to Colombian military, which often ends up with the paramilitaries, would be increased. We will continue to follow this story. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on, I also want to thank Walter Krakmal and our producer, Maria Carrion, for doing such excellent translation. We're moving on now to another international issue that the U.S. is involved with. On the 40th anniversary of his people's exile, the Dalai Lama today accused China of lacking the political will and courage to seek a compromise on Tibet. Meanwhile, Tibetan protesters in New Delhi burned 40 Chinese flags, lit firecrackers, and burned an effigy representing Chinese President Jiang Zemin. The crowd also stood in silence for a minute to honor Tibetans who died over the last four decades of Chinese rule. An estimated 5,000 people, many in traditional Tibetan dress, strode behind the Tibetan flag toward the Indian Parliament building, chanting slogans against what they call the Chinese occupation of their Himalayan homeland. Meanwhile, thousands of Tibetan refugees also held rallies in Nepal to mark this 40th anniversary of the uprising in their homeland against Chinese rule and demanded a quick resolution of the issue. And two French mountain climbers today raised a Tibetan flag over Notre Dame Cathedral, one of the best-known landmarks in Paris, in protest against Chinese rule of Tibet. They also unfurled a banner that said United Nations Justice as part of their protest on this 40th anniversary of the failed Tibetan uprising against the Chinese government. We're joined on the telephone right now by Melissa Matheson, who is a movie producer, screenwriter of Kundun. Today, a freedom march is being held from the White House to the Chinese embassy. It's being led by monks. It'll be followed by an uprising day rally and refugee camp at the Chinese embassy. Tomorrow, a hearing will be held by the House International Relations Committee on the issue of Tibet. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Melissa Matheson.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Well, you have been deeply involved with the issue of Tibet as one of the board members of the International Campaign for Tibet, the ICT. Tell us about this day, the 40th anniversary of the Tibetan uprising. What happened 40 years ago?
Well, 40 years ago, after several years of occupation, the Tibetan people, who are a very peaceful and nonviolent people, demonstrated for the first time. And, in fact, it was the women who began the demonstration. They placed themselves in front of the Potala, which is the home of the Dalai Lama in Lhasa, Tibet, and began singing. And they, of course, the Chinese occupiers in Lhasa, tried to round them up, and the men joined and the children joined, and suddenly they had a fight on their hands. And this was the first time after 10 years of occupation that the Tibetans had actually protested in this way.
And what's your reaction to the continuing attention to China from the point of view now of in recent weeks of U.S. military secrets being leaked out to China, but yet there's so little attention still placed on the continuing quest of the people of Tibet for their own self-determination?
Well, I think, you know, we all know it's about money, and it's the economic partnership between China and the United States, which is for which the human rights movement is suffering, especially in Tibet. Certainly we need to remain engaged with China. His Holiness has always suggested engagement between the superpowers as a way of helping his own people. But the fact that the situation continues, the United States has had so many opportunities to lay there, you know, to really play a hand with the Chinese about human rights and has continued to miss them or deny them is pretty sad, I think.
I was just saying that tomorrow the House International Relations Committee is going to be holding a hearing, and among those who will be speaking is a guest we had on a little while ago, actually, Columbia University professor Robert Thurman, also the U.S. Special Coordinator for Tibet, Julia Taft, and a former CIA operative, Ken Naus. Now, Melissa Matheson, in the last months, it has become public knowledge that the CIA was helping to support the Tibetan independence movement, the opposition to China, and that the Dalai Lama had been on the payroll of the CIA, had received some, what was it, $100,000+ plus per year. Can you talk about that and what you see as the significance of that?
Well, you say it's come to everyone's attention. It hasn't come to my attention. And there have been rumors of CIA involvement with the Tibetans for years. One of the biggest misconceptions is that the CIA orchestrated and choreographed the Dalai Lama's escape, which is a complete nonsense. There was no communication with the CIA at that time. The CIA did train Kamba guerrillas in Nepal and in the Himalayas to go into Tibet to wage guerrilla warfare. This did not work out very well. This is after the Dalai Lama's flight in 1959. Now, what you're telling me about this CIA payment to the Dalai Lama, I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, actually, the Dalai Lama has admitted that.
Okay,
and said
that's
that,
news to me.
Yeah. So tomorrow this hearing will take place. And what do you hope to come out of U.S. policy towards Tibet right now?
Well, as I said, I think there have been so many missed opportunities. And we are talking about a very precious people, a very precious culture and religion. You know, Tibetan Buddhism is on, although it seems to be rather popular in the United States at the moment, it is on the verge of extinction, as are these people. And what I'm hoping is that at least the United States will use what influence it has with China to promote a conversation between the Chinese rulers and His Holiness. His Holiness has bent over backwards to accept many conditions the Chinese place on meeting him. And every time he seems to accept a condition, they just up the ante or denounce him as having not accepted these conditions. So I think that in 1999, I mean, we've all been around long enough to realize that these people should sit down and talk and work out a situation for the Tibetan people that will no longer include torture and genocide.
And for those listeners who would like to add their voices in one way or another to the campaign for an end to the suppression of the Tibetan people, who can they contact?
They can contact the International Campaign for Tibet, which is based in Washington, D.C. Certainly they can get that number in the phone book, but a phone number for ICT is 202-785-1515.
That's 202-785-1515.
Correct. And anyone at that office can suggest the right congressman to write to, the right venue to voice their protest, and maybe the human rights conference taking place in Geneva beginning March 22nd is a good place to start.
Well, Melissa Matheson, thank you very much for being with us, screenwriter of Kundun and E.T. and board member of the International Campaign for Tibet on this 40th anniversary of the Tibetan uprising. Front page of the New York Times today, the administration and congressional Republicans are wrangling over how much information to make public about official findings that China acquired some of the most sensitive American military technology. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Thank you. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Last night, the Covenant Metropolitan Community Church in Birmingham, Alabama, held a vigil for Billy Jack Gaither, a man who was killed by two acquaintances on February 19th, who said they beat him to death and burned his body because he was gay. The two, Stephen Eric Mullins and Charles Monroe Butler, were arrested and have been charged with open counts of murder. A grand jury has yet to decide the exact charges. This killing mirrored that of Matthew Shepard last year in Wyoming. Matthew was tortured, beaten, and left to die, tied to a post by two men who said he'd made a pass at them. Well, across the street from last night's vigil in Birmingham, holding a counter vigil, was a group headed by Reverend Fred Phelps of the Westboro Baptist Church. Some may remember Phelps as the man who held a banner at Matthew Shepard's funeral, which said, "God hates fags," which is also the name of his website. We're now going to turn to the senior editor of Mother Jones Magazine, who interviewed Reverend Phelps and recently published a long story about his group. Carrie Lauerman is on the line with us from San Francisco. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us who Phelps is?
Well, I think that's a big question. I'm not quite sure Fred Phelps knows who he is, but he's, I can tell you, I spent about a week with him and his family in Topeka, which is where he's based and where his ministry, Westboro Baptist, is based. And he has a presence in Topeka like no one else, not necessarily definitely not a good one. Everyone in town knows who he is. And they fear him. And the best that I could tell, kind of following and tracing his career, he's been in Topeka for 40 years. He's 69 now, so he's has an older presence in town. He has always been the outsider. What I found maybe the most interesting detail about him is his in a previous life, in the 50s and 60s, he was actually a civil rights attorney and won many awards from local chapters of the NAACP for representing African Americans in workplace discrimination suits. So it's fascinating that he's become this kind of icon of gay hatred against gays. But the best I can tell, his life has been made up of being isolated and against the world. You know, it's kind of been him against the world. And in the past, there's been some good that's come out of that. But right now, it's he's focusing his anger, his perfect hate, which is what he and his family call it, toward gays.
Before we move on with Reverend Phelps, Bill Singleton has joined us on the line as well from Birmingham, Alabama, a reporter for the Birmingham Post-Herald, and he covered the vigil last night for Billy Jack Gaither at the Covenant Metropolitan Community Church in Birmingham. Can you tell us what it was like and what Reverend Phelps was doing across the street?
Well, a lot of people showed up for the vigil.
If you could speak as loud as you can.
A lot of people showed up for the vigil, about 200 individuals, maybe even more. A lot of them were from the gay community. You had some ministers there who were, I would say, probably represent the liberal branch of Christianity. Reverend Phelps was across the street because he did not have a permit, did not apply for a permit. He could only have six demonstrators, and they each had to be about 10 feet apart. And they were roughly about 40 yards away from the church site where people were filing in. It was rather peaceful. He didn't shout across the street, and no one from the other side shouted towards him. He did have his billboards, and some motorists, as they drove past, probably shouted things at him. But it was fairly quiet protest.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Carrie Lauerman, how long has Phelps been pulling these publicity stunts at these major public events? And if you had during the time that you interviewed him, were you able to get a sense of when it was that he started focusing in on his anti-gay crusade?
Yeah, it really was launched in 91-92 when Bill Clinton was running for office, and it was really the first time in our country where politicians were openly courting the gay vote. And for Fred Phelps, I think he started his protest locally in Topeka. His most protests start out, and got a lot of publicity just, you know, protesting a local city councilwoman who he identified as being pro-gay. He quickly went national, and I think it was early 93 is when he made his first really big splash. He protested a big gay rights march on Washington around the gays in the military issue, and you know, he was everywhere. He was on Nightline, I think. He was in all of the four major newscasts, evening news, and 2020 did a special on him. So that was really the launch of his public career, and he claims that he does 1,000 protests a year, most of them locally, but he travels about once a month someplace as well, so that he's constantly doing what he did in Birmingham last night. He's showing up to a place often very unprepared for what he's going to do, and shocks people, and hopes that he gets some publicity out of it as well.
And do you have any sense of whether he's actually gathering any kind of significant following? Or as you mentioned in your article, at least in Topeka, he hasn't, and in Kansas, he hasn't been very successful in his attempts to run for any public office. He's regularly trounced by huge margins.
Right. Yes. No. There's no. And I looked for any indication that there was, you know, a big group of supporters out there that he was mobilizing. You know, he likes to point to his website, which I think he says gets something like 200,000 hits a month. But when you think about it, a website, that's not an enormous number of hits, and something as outrageous as his, a pretty outrageous website, people are going to stumble upon it for a variety of reasons. So there's no real indication that he's getting a lot of supporters behind him. But I would say there's also, you know, in fact, I think this is worth pointing out, Birmingham is a little different than some of his recent protests. Quite the opposite has happened. He's protested a couple different lesbian weddings in Sacramento and in Chicago, and word got out ahead of time that he was going to come picket these weddings, and thousands of people turned out in counter-protests. So, in fact, there's every indication that he's mobilizing more people, vastly greater numbers of people against him than for him.
On his website that we were going through yesterday is this really horrendous picture of Matthew Shepard, just a picture of his face. And the website picture moves, and you see flames, and you hear Matthew screaming, and it says Matthew is burning in hell. It says his message from hell. It goes on from there. And I wanted to ask you about this organizing on the internet. It's something that the Southern Poverty Law Center has put out in its reports, talking about the growing influence of hate groups on the internet.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, he does claim that he's getting, you know, dozens of email a day. He actually, that email site is run out of Kansas University. It's a website of one of his grandchildren who has the website set up there. And you know, he claims it's very successful. However, there's no indication it's a small ministry. He has 9 children who are very active within the church. Fred Phelps does, who all are you know, most of them are lawyers, received law degrees at the local college, and are gainfully employed, and, you know, really spend their resources going around and running their pickets. But I attended one service in Topeka, of his one Sunday service, and it was a packed service, but everyone there was related to Fred Phelps in some way. It was a family service. Everyone, save for one person, was related to Phelps. So, you know, if he's rallying the masses, there's no visual indication that people are being riled up by him.
We're talking to Carrie Lauerman, senior editor for Mother Jones Magazine, who just published a story in the magazine called The Man Who Loves to Hate. And Bill Singleton is with us from Birmingham, Alabama, who reported last night on the vigil in the Birmingham Post-Herald, where he writes, Bill Singleton, these things that Carrie Lauerman is talking about, the story of Reverend Phelps, did you know about it? And are you writing about it in the Birmingham Post-Herald?
Yes, we were familiar with his story. In fact, as soon as the vigil was announced, almost immediately, I think that Reverend Phelps had faxed some information to area news organizations to comment on the Gaither situation and to announce that he was coming down. It's interesting that Reverend Phelps is, as the writer was saying, or senior editor was saying, that he is extreme of what is considered extreme. He doesn't like Jerry Falwell, doesn't like the Southern Baptist Convention, and he even said that Billy Graham is going soft. And for people who in the religious community have a great reverence for Billy Graham, so he not only has attacked homosexuals, but he's against those people who don't join his crusade. I did do a short story in our paper about Reverend Phelps and his presence in Birmingham at the vigil.
And what has been the response of local activists in Birmingham, other church groups in Birmingham, to Reverend Phelps? And is there protest decrying what he represents?
Well, it's interesting because in Birmingham, we do have a number of conservative religious organizations, churches. And there seems to be a dilemma because, on the one hand, they don't like what Reverend Phelps stands for and the way that he does it. By showing up at grieving sites and protesting. That's not the way that they would do that. But on the other hand, many of the groups do support or do agree with his position on homosexuality, and they may not be as strong in terms of condemnation, but theologically and according to the traditional Christian position, they would agree that homosexuality is not right. It's interesting, and I noted that at the vigil, you had some ministers there. You had a showing from the religious community, and I pointed out that it was more those who have a more liberal, if I can use that term, viewpoint of Christianity being represented there. And that distinction I made because it shows that there, even though we have a strong religious presence within Birmingham area within Alabama, you still have a theological divide, so to speak, between those who hold a conservative Christian viewpoint and those who are more liberal, I would say, in their theology.
Well, Carrie Lauerman, if it's true that he doesn't have a big following, then what is there any real significance to him? I understand that there are some people who basically say that what he's doing is, in essence, making other extremists on the right look even more palatable just by his out-extreming them, if that's conceivable.
Yeah, I mean, I think you always have that phenomenon on you know, the political spectrum. Somebody comes along that's outrageous, and he manages to, you know, he allows the Gary Bowers and Trent Lotz to seem fair, a little more reasonable, because they can say, we certainly don't agree with what he's saying, that's extreme. But what I think is most, just listening to what's happening in Birmingham, what I kind of thought is most interesting, I found most interesting about Phelps in Topeka is that here you have him, it's kind of ground zero of his protest, and I think, you know, in light of the Matthew Shepard and Billy Jack Gaither killings, there's a growing kind of large national sense that compassion for gays is growing as a result. There are these kind of national outpourings of compassion marches in the Capitol and different major cities. But here in Topeka, where you have this kind of constant assault on the gays in town, there is no real indication that there's a lot of compassion for gays. The gay people that I met in Topeka were afraid to be out publicly. about their sexuality. They really fear him, and I think he does manage to keep them in the closet by and large. And the city, meanwhile, has done nothing really to protect gay people from Phelps. It's a very conservative area, as its own Alabama is, and really much of the South and Midwest. And while neighboring cities have passed legislation right in Kansas to protect gays from discrimination in the workplace and whatnot, Topeka's resisted that. And, you know, there are examples in town of gay people who have literally been run out of their jobs and run out of town by Phelps. So I think what I was most struck by is how little the town itself seems to be kind of protecting gay people, or you know, the idea that when you have somebody who's so openly hateful, you would it would naturally breed a compassion. I didn't really see that in Topeka.
Well, Carrie Lauerman and Bill Singleton, I want to thank you for joining us. And Carrie Lauerman, as you point out in your piece, the children, even the supporting children of Reverend Phelps, know his wrath well as they talk about him beating them as they grew up. Carrie Lauerman, senior editor for Mother Jones. You can see this article on the website and in the next issue of Mother Jones magazine, the website www.motherjones.com. And Bill Singleton, reporter for the Birmingham Post-Herald in Birmingham, Alabama. Well, that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Today, our engineer, Bernard White. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
You don't know what I'm talking about yet, but I'm going to tell you soon. It's a pity. Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a shame? We break each other's hearts and cause each other pain. How we take each other's love.